This is John Williams. You did it again, or maybe for the first time. You found The Mincing Rascals, our weekly podcast. It's produced by Elif Garris. We're doing it over Zoom, and doggone it, the technology works, but it doesn't work great this weekend. It's so frustrating for me. I probably shouldn't even bring it up, but thanks for listening and being patient with the technology. We're all going to get through this, and when we do, we'll all be back in the studio, and it'll sound a little cleaner. By the way, did you get that knee cleaned out of yours? He said, segueing to the commercial part of the podcast. The Joint Relief Institute is in Orland Park in Oak Brook. They've got digital imaging. They see where your knee's compromised, and then they actually don't go in and clean her out. What they do is they put a lubricant into the spot where that tissue is deteriorated. This is a non-surgical, pain-free, quick, think of it as Jiffy lubing of your knee. It's really like that, and it's all they do. They're expert at it. They're really good at it. You're going to like the experience, also because the first visit is free, and your insurance almost surely is going to pay for it, and they've got an insurance specialist to help you with that. So let's go for that pain-free, socially distanced, smart, safe walk. I want you to go to the Joint Relief Institute first. Call 708-888-0000 or visit jointreliefinstitute.com. 708-888-0000, as in zero pain. Today is Thursday, May 21st, 2020. It's 1:45 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams. This is The Mincing Rascals, the podcast we record at the studios of WGN Radio in Chicago. We're still doing it quarantined over Zoom. You can hear me weekdays from 9 to noon on WGN Radio.
I'm Heather Sharone from WTTW News.
I'm Steve Bertrand from WGN Radio News. I'm concerned that my beard makes me look fat on Zoom.
It makes you look a lot of things, Steve.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Eric Zorn, the morbidly insightful columnist from Chicago Tribune.
Am I missing another political jab?
No, you're missing. This was Nancy Pelosi referring to Donald Trump as morbidly obese.
Something that has not been approved by the scientist, especially in his age group and in his, shall we say, weight group, but is morbidly obese, they say. So I think it's not a good idea.
How do you score that?
Yeah, it was definitely a cheap shot. He is not morbidly obese by any definition. I think she was just jabbing back at him because of all the ways that she, the ways that he has over the years been so dismissive of women and talking about appearances and so on.
I gave him a dose of his own medicine. He's called women one thing or another over time, and I thought he thinks that passes off as humor in certain cultures, and I thought that was what that was. And I was only quoting what doctors had said about him, so I was being factual in a very sympathetic way.
It was in reference to the president announcing that he's been taking hydrochloroquine. And she said maybe that's not a good idea, given the fact that he's old and morbidly obese. I don't know what the definition of morbidly is. His weight's funny. Sometimes he looks pretty good in a suit, and then you'll see him with his golf clothes on. This man has to stop eating at McDonald's.
If it had been said about a woman, there'd been an outcry, and it was a cheap shot. She should have been above that. She could have found a different way to ding him.
I think of like that, and then I think of the way that she tore up his State of the Union speech recently. I think those are sort of unforced errors that you just don't need to get down in the mud with him on things like that. There's so many things that you can and should get down in the mud with him about, but his weight is not one of them.
He's vain, and that is, if you just wanted to throw him off the rails for a couple of days, that really bugs him.
These people are sick. Pelosi is a sick woman. She's got a lot of problems, a lot of mental problems. We're dealing with people that have to get their act together for the good of the country.
I'm looking up fattest presidents.
I mean, it's obviously Howard Taft.
I was going to say, you got to go Taft. You got to go Taft.
Yeah, well, that's what you'd think. Grover Cleveland is said to clock in around 280.
So I don't know that we can trust the data that the White House gives. Honestly, I don't. I don't have any confidence that they're actually telling us the truth, because it's clearly a worse spot for him.
Grover was pushing it. This is, according to Men's Health, which is probably the best article on Men's Health that there is, but Grover Cleveland's clocking in at 34% BMI.
I think Grover Cleveland and Aaron Schock are the only two politicians to ever get a cover of Men's Health.
Nice. Both ends of the spectrum there, too. Are you guys interested in the sorts of numbers that are being reported
relative to deaths and reported positive COVID-19 cases. There's an argument that they're overreported. There's an argument that they're underreported. You know, maybe it doesn't matter.
There's an argument that it's being overreported. There's absolutely no evidence to suggest that. There's a significant amount of evidence to suggest that deaths from the coronavirus are significantly underreported.
Well, I guess it depends on how you keep score, right? Because if somebody dies with a number of conditions attendant to their death, and COVID-19 is one of them, COVID gets put on the death certificate, but they also had diabetes.
Right. But we've heard Dr. Ezeke from the Illinois Department of Health talk about this extensively, that it's only listed as a cause of death if it's clear that that COVID-19 exacerbated that condition, which is an oftentimes chronic, longstanding condition, to the part where it becomes acute and therefore terminal. So there's just no serious evidence to suggest that the death toll is being overreported. And a significant amount of instances where people are dying alone at home and not going to the emergency rooms to suggest that it's vastly understated.
So to quote Hillary Clinton in the Benghazi hearings, what does it matter in that much? I mean, if it's 10,000 more people than we know or 10,000 fewer, I agree with you, Heather, there's no way it's fewer. I just think this is one of those fights that's not really worth having, because what I'm interested in are the new hospitalizations and getting through this and getting over it, not a precise number of people in the end who've died.
Hospitalizations, I think, is definitely the key still. And then in terms of like Pritzker releasing data, I think the only ding on his data stuff was that they were releasing hospitalizations too late. I don't think that came on a daily basis until like the second week of April, which was too late. On the other stuff, I haven't seen. And then also, I don't think they release comorbidity stuff at the state level. I think they do it at Cook County. So that should also be something that they're reporting, but aren't.
Well, there's the theory that doctors or hospitals get a larger check if they put COVID-19 in the box. And so they're incentivized to overreport it. And the politics are in play, too. Why are you shaking your head, Heather?
It's not true. Hospitals and nursing homes don't get more money if they say this person died of coronavirus. That's just a false right-wing talking point.
Well, I'm hearing it on my text line every day.
Well, there you go.
There you go.
And does the hospital declare the manner of death, or does that go to the ME?
It's the ME.
Yeah.
But so if you put someone on a ventilator, you do get more money from the federal government. For doing
right,
that.
But that's because it costs the hospital more money to put you
right.
on a ventilator.
But they really did go on a ventilator.
Right. It's not like they're just saying that there's no evidence that people are being listed as being on ventilators when they're not on ventilators. So
no, I heard they take people off the street, wrestle them in there. They jam that tube down their throat.
Honestly, John, this is the problem. You know, you get these texts or people believe this stuff. I mean, there are people, there was a talking point yesterday that the Democrats somehow breached the dams in Midland, Michigan, because it was a Republican stronghold. You know, I mean, there are these, God, I get so upset with these. I don't know if I get more upset with the people who spread the rumors or the people who are, and not you, but are willing to believe anything and not think about anything before they think it's probably true.
And all those people in Midland who are have lost their homes, those are just crisis actors.
Right.
There's all this stuff going on about you know, the virus, whether it was man-made. This is a fetid swamp of conspiracy theories right now.
And it isn't, limited to the GOP. We saw Kimberly Lightford, the former chair of the Black Caucus, say that she believed that the virus was man-made. And she was on Mike Flannery's show, and that just took my breath away as well. And she was challenged on it, and she just said, well, that's just my opinion.
And she came very close to being the president of the Illinois Senate.
She was Pritzker's pick.
I kind of rolled my eyes at Willie Wilson's philanthropy this week when he decided that he would pay. He said on our radio station today up to $1 million in the fines that churches suffer if they open with more than 10 people, which is what they're supposed to do now. The governor's sort of softened the rollout plan for Illinois. Austin, do you want to grade that or tell us what you think about what's happening now?
It's been such a whirlwind the past like 3 days, and it's going to be insane today and tomorrow too, because legislators are in session. They're trying to pass a budget. They're trying to do COVID response. They're trying to change the election code all in 3 days. All that adds up to usually bad stuff's going on in Illinois state government when that happens. So, I think in terms of his, the one huge overreach, which we fought very hard back against, was his Class A misdemeanor classification for small businesses that violated his stay-at-home order. And he was trying to push that through, or he was forced to essentially get that through what's called the Joint Committee on Administrative Rules, which is this very obscure committee. And the fact that that happened created this weird glitch in the matrix, because Madigan's whole MO, his entire career, is just don't make no waves. Like, don't put your members on stuff that's really controversial. And this is very, was extremely controversial, because it comes with up to a year in jail time. So there's a committee with six Republicans and six Democrats that have to vote on this. And to strike it down, to strike down his rule, you would need 8 votes. So you'd have to flip 2 Democrats. And the meeting was supposed to be at 10:30. They delayed it an hour. They delayed it another hour. They delayed it another hour, then met, and then Pritzker rescinded his order.
So Democrats were going to flip on it.
Yeah.
Or they didn't want to cast a vote to stick right with it. They, you know, as Ed Austin said, you don't want to cast a vote that's just going to make people mad. And the thing is, I understand why that is such a poisonous idea of a businessman trying to stay in business, and or businesswoman, and then they get fined and thrown and potentially thrown in jail. Pritzker said he had no intention of throwing anyone in jail, and I believe him on that. On the other hand, what do you do? What does a state government do if there is, if there's all these scoff laws out there? People are just not going to obey the law.
Eric, let me give you an example that's actually occurring right now. One of the ministers who's keeping his church open was just on John's show, and I was on the show too. And he, you know, he said he's going to continue to hold services.
Of course we'll pay. The moment this was threatened and that $500 number was going around, people from our church stepped up and started giving generously. Now we hear Willie Wilson made a public statement yesterday saying he'll pay them all. So it's not a matter of money at this point. We're going to keep going forward.
So there's no way to punish him or to deter him from doing it short of jail time. And I don't think he should be going to jail, but it's sort of an instance where maybe he should be going to the only, you know, you could hurt a businessman by fining him. You can hurt a businessman by taking a license. This minister can only be hurt by being incarcerated.
And I appreciate Steve's point here. And that's the honesty that's necessary. You can't be someone like Pritzker and say, I never intended to arrest anyone. Like, yeah, we all know the history of the Chicago Police Department and criminal justice in Illinois in general being really lax on imprisoning people who do stuff that's wrong. If you didn't intend to do that, don't make it a Class A misdemeanor. Just make it a fine. He decided to push that way to the extreme. And yeah, there's a great quote. Friedrich Bastiat talked about how if you want to have if you want respect for law, you have to have respectable laws. And every rule ultimately comes at the point of a gun. Like, at some point, you're either going to enforce it or not. So that's why you need to be very careful when people say, like, well, I want people to do X, Y, Z. Well, are you prepared to back up a cop who decides to arrest a pastor? If you're not, then don't pass that rule.
Right.
Well, and it sure sets up the bad image of releasing people from Cook County because they're worried about the COVID-19 virus in the jail. And you're going to let them out and you're going to put in business people and pastors because they're trying to serve their congregants or survive economically. Those two passing in the parking lot looks pretty bad for the state, for the governor, or just for planning around this thing.
I do think that there probably never was a plan to arrest people. I just don't think that was ever going to happen.
So he's going to hold services this weekend. 150 yeah. people he thinks in his church, and you know, he didn't say they're taking their temperature at the door. They're all just going to hope they don't have it and spread it.
So, I mean, this whole conversation does get around to what in a society. We understand that a lot of it, a lot of the compliance we have to rules is voluntary, and that we really don't have the mechanisms in place to ultimately say you fine a businessman or businesswoman and they don't pay the fine. You can try to close them down, but say they stay open. I mean, it's at some point, Austin's right, at some point, you know, if you're going to have a rule like this, it has to be able to be enforced with a gun or with jail time. So it makes you realize that really a lot of the way society is structured is through these norms and through these understandings that, yeah, we can't have a law that prevents everybody from driving 100 miles an hour on the Kennedy if we all decided to do it. But there's this social sense that prevents us from doing that. Right now, you've got these pastors who are willing to say, we're not taking this seriously. We think that our rights to assemble in this configuration is greater. Our rights are greater than the rights of our society to protect itself from this health hazard. And what are you going to do about it? And it's a really good question.
Well, the one thing I wish the governor would address more consistently when he does these, are they still daily press briefings? We aren't taking them every day.
Yeah, they're not during the weekend, but Monday through Friday,
the unemployment insurance situation, people still don't have checks. It's still clunky and inconsistent. People still, the phones aren't getting picked up. I don't know what you all are hearing out there, but it's making people mad. Crazy trying to figure it out. And very frustrated because some of them are literally waiting every day to see if the money is put on their card or if they get a deposit in their account.
It's been awful. We actually got back, I was on the news this morning talking about a response we got back regarding the data breach or the glitch that happened last week where thousands of people had their social security number and first name posted online by IDES. So we got back that affected 32,000 people had their first name. So these are people, by the way, these are the gig workers. So imagine you're in their shoes. You just waited 7 weeks to get money that the feds have approved weeks ago. Pritzker puts up a roadblock the week before saying you need to go through the traditional process and then do this. Then they do it and the state publishes your social security number online and you still don't have your benefits. That is like the most Kafka-esque thing I've ever heard. It's maddening. And yeah, we get calls every single day. We got 50 calls yesterday, people wanting unemployment insurance and couldn't figure out how to get through.
I think that, the governor has said he's opened up a whole separate call center. And as I understand it, that has reduced delays and sort of allowed people to get through. But there's no doubt that the system was completely overended. We saw a new data today that showed that unemployment in Illinois is worse than at any point since the Great Depression, nearly more than 16%, and more than 285,000 Illinoisans have lost their job in the last month. And that doesn't even reflect people who haven't filed yet. So I think the question is, did the governor and his staff do a bad job of preparing for this? Sure. Was the system broken before this happened? And has this broken it further? I think there's ample evidence to suggest that. The question is, there's so much, there are just so many people that it begs the question as to whether any system would have been able to handle an influx like this at any point.
I think the answer to that, Heather, is that there are states that are doing this pretty well. Austin, you may have a better handle on this than I do, but Illinois is clearly overwhelmed by this. It is a once in a century event, but that other states are suffering similar levels of unemployment and are doing a better job. Obviously it wasn't Pritzker alone dropping the ball, but he wasn't ready for it, but Illinois wasn't ready for it. Is that fair to say?
I think so. And I think Heather's point is right about it was a broken system before and now it's even more broken. The Illinois consistently is among the top five states in overpayment of benefits. Like we overpaid $170 million in unemployment benefits last year. So yeah, that office was not efficient to begin with.
Why did
you look
at
that? Mismanagement. So in Michigan, for instance, I think we have around in Illinois 1.1 million unemployment claims. In Michigan, I think they have over 1.6, and they were letting gig workers in weeks ago. Colorado, same thing. The difference in the states comes down to identifying the problem quickly, taking ownership of the problem, and then keeping people updated on how you're solving it. And Pritzker, at every turn, kept saying, well, first, it was the federal government's fault because there's some rules about training workers. Then it was something like this new computer glitch. Deloitte was brought in to build a new system. It's all taking too long, is the point. And other states are processing way more of these.
I just want somebody to yell at. So if the governor can stand there or if Dr. Arwadi can stand there, why can't the interim head of the IDES system stand there every day and give us, it's important that we have a daily press briefing on the health side, Why aren't we having a daily press briefing dedicated exclusively to the financial side? And let those people be there and take the tough questions every single day. And every single day they can say, I don't know, or we're working on it, or we're doing the best we can. But there's no accountability. They're invisible. You can't even find these people.
The IDES head has not been at any of these press conferences, I believe. And Pritzker said that he wouldn't be.
That's amazing. That's amazing to me.
Have you tried to get him on the air, John?
The governor's office?
No, the IDES people.
Yes to both. We literally call the governor's office every single day. I know he's got a lot to do, but this is the largest talk radio station in Chicago. They never even acknowledge our texts and calls. They don't even say we can't do it. We get no response. Terry Savage was on with us this week, you know, the Tribune financial columnist. She's on our station too. And she has given up hope that they'll respond or respond in a meaningful way. I hate to keep piling on or stating the obvious, but I'm more frustrated with that than anything else right now. And I'm employed. I'm getting a paycheck.
So my son graduated from college this week.
Congratulations.
Thank you. You might have watched it online. So he 6 months ago was going to graduate into the best job market in the history of the country, and now it's maybe the worst. And this isn't personal, but so what happens to that class of people, those 22-year-olds who become of age, they're coming out of school and would be eligible for unemployment had they been fired, but they never were hired. So they just kind of have to just exist, right? They're kind of a donut hole
Wow.
when it comes to federal assistance, right?
I hadn't thought about that.
Totally.
Well, as I'm a father of two graduates this month from college, and
Congrats.
Sort of the same situation. My daughter's getting unemployment because she was working while she was a student. So she's actually on the rolls. And money's coming through. But my son has been out of state and was just a full-time student. So
it's
a great question. I'm not sure.
Are they getting loan forgiveness for 6 months? I think they don't have to start paying on their loans for half a year. Is that right?
March through September for federal student loans.
There's a lot of interesting conversation about renters and landlords and what's going to happen with that. And there's a fairly strong movement in the city and I think in the state as well now to have a form of rent forgiveness. And realize when you do that, of course, you end up putting the burden on landlords. So they need to help fund the landlords who are giving the tenants rent forgiveness. And the question that I'm sure Austin's organization is asking very loudly is, where is all this money going to come from?
Well, what's interesting is we're in a new circumstance where the Federal CARES Act money, the rules have been loosened to allow economic assistance with that money. So what we've been talking to people about is use it for property tax relief. You can use it for all sorts of economic relief. And I haven't seen that done yet. Now, I'm not asking for it to be done tomorrow. I think there should be a broader conversation about what to do with that money. But it does seem like you could use some federal aid that's already been given to the state for some economic assistance for people.
Just can we talk about some of the specifics about what's supposed to happen? Heather, what are you hearing about the plan, both from Lori Lightfoot and JB on all of this?
Well, yesterday, so that would be Wednesday, Governor JB Pritzker said that he had seen new data that prompted him to change the phase three of his plan, which would allow restaurants to serve a limited number of outdoor diners. But just a couple of minutes ago today on Thursday, Lori Lightfoot said, well, not so fast for Chicago. There are a lot of rules that the city is still trying to work out. So that's not going to happen on May 29th in Chicago. Perhaps sometime in June. So a bit of cold water, so to speak.
Wow. That's terrible. I mean, I'm not kidding you. I left work yesterday with a sense of joy, you know, just because we were moving forward and it was a way to truly know change. And I'm sitting in here. I know Lightfoot started at 1:00. I didn't hear that she had done that. That's heartbreaking.
So she trumps the governor then? Is that what you're saying?
In the city, so yeah.
They can put in stricter regulations than the state, but they can't loosen up faster than the governor. So I mean, the fact of the matter is that originally the CDC plan for reopening called for declining cases for 14 days. Chicago has yet to see a single day of declining cases. And, you know, the mayor says it's just too soon, even as things are improving.
Okay, but wait, no, this is a conversation I have 20 times a day. And I know that we all do. So the CDC says a declining number of cases, right? Is that right. That's what you're saying, just cases. So how can we have a declining number of cases if we're ramping up the number of tests by tens of thousands, right? It's only right. natural that they're, that's a terrible way to measure it.
Sure, it is. But that's the CDC. That's the CDC standard. Now, the mayor has said, all right, we'll focus on positivity, but we're not, and we're doing okay there. But I think the mayor is concerned that if you reopen the restaurants, even in limited capacity, you're going to see a surge that's going to roll back whatever limited progress has been made, which is also her argument for keeping the lakefront closed, which she has said won't happen until phase four of the Chicago reopening plan.
Moving from phase two to phase three, we have to be at or under 20% positivity rate.
So that's statewide. Chicago has a little right. bit of a different metric for that.
Okay.
So Chicago is allowing more positive cases in congregate settings, such as like Cook County Jail and nursing homes. And they want to see, and so that's 30% positivity. The city has a 20% positivity rate. Okay. It has to be under that.
And of course, this does all get back to who's being tested and how many tests are being performed. And so on, which makes these sort of phantom goals in a way, right? I mean, isn't the key metric still hospitalizations and death?
I would think so. I would think hospitalizations, because that shows you the number of people that are truly being sick enough to go to hospitals.
Or positive results per test. I mean, for every 1,000 tests, if the number goes down, that's what the governor was talking about this week, right?
And that's where we are right now, which is really good news. But I think the sense is that if we take these couple of days of good news and then sort of loosen up, that you're going to lose whatever progress has been made. And this is the part of the Mincing Rascals where I remind us that it's the African-American and the Latino communities of Chicago that are being hit incredibly disproportionately hard. I did some quick math just a couple minutes ago that, you know, nearly 75% of all deaths in Chicago are Black and Latino Chicagoans. So that is a crazily high disproportionate rate. So if you reopen restaurants, who's going to fill those jobs? Black and Latino Chicagoans. Who's going to potentially get sicker? Black and Latino Chicagoans. And I think that that's something that, as much as Steve really wants to go get a margarita on a patio somewhere, that we have to think about what our obligation to our fellow citizens are, like Eric was talking.
Listen, don't make assumptions about me. I have had margaritas on patios. I'm sick of my patio.
What happens? Do you think that the reluctance to open restaurants has to do with the employees? Because Governor Pritzker in opening up on a week from Friday, is opening up for outdoor service only, which is probably pretty safe if you've got the table 6 feet apart. And
you don't have to go to the bathroom.
Yeah. Or is it the employees that they're mostly worried about?
The sense is that it's a little bit of both. I mean, because if somebody gets sick and if somebody is asymptomatic and doesn't get tested and spreads that virus, we're off to the races again.
This all began so that we could maintain capacity in our hospitals. It wasn't to eradicate the virus. And so if hospitalizations go down and it looks as if we are not, you know, we're not going to be overrun. When we started playing this game, when we all started playing willingly, that means that they were going to start opening things up. I just feel like we're going to have anarchy. This whole thing's just going to collapse of its own weight if we don't start moving to open some things up.
Well, as the summer comes on, that there's going to be the frustration will mount. John, in talking to people, I asked you this last week, and you said, yeah, you were feeling the pressure building, that the anger is building, that even though most of the surveys still show that the majority of people are still more concerned about going too quickly than going too slowly, but that you're hearing these louder voices and these protests more. Is that still the case?
Yeah, Yeah. And it's kind of going the way the politics in this country go. I think as a result of that, the other side digs their heels even more. If there was ever at the beginning this sort of, hey, we all are in this together moment, such as it was, now it's very, very polarized.
Still don't think that we have any data to show that. I think that we're still seeing like between 70 and 80% of people being way more concerned that things are opening up faster than they should, as opposed to staying closed for too long. And there was a really insightful piece in the Washington Post that went to a mall in suburban Atlanta that had reopened and talked to the shoppers who were all like, this is great. I'm not at risk. I can't wait. And the workers just being absolutely terrified that they were signing their death warrant by going back to work. So, you know, I also think that it's an important thing to think about that we're not hearing the voices of the people working in the meatpacking plants. We're not hearing the voices of the people forced to work. And because we all have time to sit around and, you know, be keyboard warriors, we aren't hearing from the people who are most at risk of dying. And that honestly is the central question, is how much death, how many people are you willing to see die to resume some form of normal economic activity?
But Heather, that question sounds loaded, and I know you don't mean it to be, but that is always the honest truth.
Opened up everything today, significantly more people would die. And there was a new story from the AP today that showed that nearly 36,000 more people died than would have if things had shut down 1 week earlier. So if we know that now, and we're saying, let's rush and reopen things now, that means we're with that knowledge. We're saying that whatever deaths occur, we are acknowledging and we are willing as a society to bear it. I don't know the answer to that question, right. but that's what we're doing.
So I would say two things. I saw that study that had reclosed on a week earlier, but I don't think anyone in the country, any leader or any citizen really, except maybe Austin, who saw this coming, would have been willing at that time to shut down a week earlier. That's one thing. But the other thing about how many people are willing to see die, you're right. That's a genuine question. But we always knew we were going to be facing this question when we started the lockdown. The lockdown was to bend the curve and to support hospital capacity. We knew that when we started to ease it, people would continue to die or more people would die. That's the sort of the devil's bargain that we got into from the very beginning. We just have to figure out, and I think in some cases we're there. It's time to start opening up a little bit.
You know, Heather's making it sound like the community who you are most willing to jeopardize, Steve, are these marginalized communities.
Well, it's a great point.
If it were middle-class white people like us, who were most at risk of dying and who were most at risk of, you know, facing potentially a lifetime of health concerns, because we don't know what coronavirus does to the body in terms of like the long term.
Okay, I've got to go. I'm sorry. I don't mean to keep interrupting, but just I do understand your point. My parents are 78 years old, so they are at risk and they're being very careful. My mother-in-law is in an assisted living center where there have been coronavirus cases. So I think you're right. I get it about the populations at risk, but I do have some skin in the game too. I mean, so it's not just the minority communities. It's the old folks as well.
You got to leave us, Steve?
Bye-bye.
All right. See, Steve's going back into the WGN radio newsroom. And so
gets the last word and drops the microphone.
No, because we now get to dismantle everything he said. It reminds me a little, though, of when a child goes missing. If it's a cute blonde-haired girl, there's a, you know, they're on every TV station, local and national. All the networks cover, where is Cindy? That happens every day in Chicago, and it doesn't get that sort of attention. Austin, you were leaning into your camera there. What were you about to say?
Well, I just have bad posture, but in Georgia, I believe hospitalizations are down down one-third since the lockdown was lifted in Georgia. And
in Georgia, where they put out data that rearranged the days so that it looked like it was going down when it was actually going up?
Well, maybe. I'm just talking about hospitalizations. I think they're down a third.
I'm talking about case counts. I'm just saying that when a state messes with the data, I almost said a bad word, I tend to be very skeptical of other data.
Take out Georgia. JP Morgan put out a great study, I think it was 2 days ago, where they plotted every state with deaths and lockdown measures, and they weren't able to yet. This isn't to say that this won't be found. It could this could very well be a very strong relationship, but there isn't evidence yet to show that the lockdowns on a state-to-state basis had a big impact on deaths. What my hypothesis is that what we're going to see have a huge effect on state-to-state deaths is how nursing homes were treated. So if people were allowing COVID patients back into nursing homes, and at what point they restricted all visits to nursing homes, I think that one policy action, I think, may end up mattering more than any other. But I think it's too early to tell.
And what you're also seeing, even in places like Georgia and Florida, is that a lot of people are still practicing physical distancing, and they're wearing masks, and they're really taking this seriously. It's not like they've just said, okay, all over, we sounded the alarm, you know, everyone's back and, you know, going shoulder to shoulder in bars like they're in Wisconsin. You know, that this is, that people are being cautious, and that is still, that's helping the spread. And so maybe the idea is that we can relax the formal rules as long as the informal practices remain fairly strong.
Well, Eric, do you have confidence in people's civility in that regard?
Not particularly, no, because of the way what we saw happen in Wisconsin last week. I mean, people just, as soon as that ruling came down from the Wisconsin Supreme Court, people ran out to the bars and linked arms, basically. It makes you realize that there is a significant percentage, a dangerous percentage of people who either think this is a hoax or think it won't happen to them, or think it's just a bunch of old black and brown people in Chicago who are getting sick and they don't have to worry about it. And that's kind of what you're seeing, I think, in vast swaths of the state where you don't see many cases and people just don't, they almost don't think it's real. So as soon as they get as soon as the all clear horn blows, they rush out and congregate the way they shouldn't. And I'm expecting there to be a spike in cases based on what happened in Wisconsin last week.
Well, we might. I mean, depending on the latency period, who knows? Maybe we'll be talking the next podcast about the spike in Appleton, and I'm trying to think of some of the towns.
Kenosha, right? Lake Geneva? Mm-hmm.
Picture of a fudge store. I assume it was in Lake Geneva.
Is that what you're running up there for? It's not
here in the I just saw market. A picture. I didn't go.
We asked our listeners to score how well people in their neighborhood were doing about face masks and just accommodating one another, still being good stewards of each other's health. And it was a perfectly bell-shaped curve. They were giving their neighborhoods a C with either numbers A to F on either side, but it was this nice little bell-shaped curve. And to Steve's point a little while ago, I think the longer we wait, the worse that grade's going to get. And maybe as much as we might say, I'm nervous about us being too aggressive, you know, opening up the state, Steve keeps saying, if we don't, the dam's going to burst. So Heather, you may disagree with the science on that, but the reality is you got to give them something or they're just going to ignore everything.
I mean, I think it's a possibility. I also think it's a possibility that what Eric was talking about happens. And then people just say, look, I'm not an epidemiologist. I don't feel safe gambling with my health or my kids' health. So I'm just going to stay home until I have a higher certainty level. And I think the best case scenario is that I feel confident in going and spending money, but I won't do that until I'm confident that I'm not going to catch a virus and die or give it to my kids. So it seems like if you get the science of it right, you would get the economic part of it right. And I you know, as much as we want to leap over getting that science part of it right, it seems like, you know, we just simply can't.
What grade do you give your community, Heather?
You know, I have not been out and about very much. I got to tell you the truth.
Getting an A. That's because you're getting an A, Missy.
I've been forcing my husband to do the grocery and Target runs, but I want to say I was in Walgreens this week, and I want to say everybody in the store had a mask on, which was nice and good, but there were also people sort of on the street that weren't wearing masks and didn't appear to have masks at the ready, which made me wonder, What are you doing, dudes? But
how about you, Austin? What grade do you give your neighborhood?
The park by me is Jonquil Park, and people are keeping distant. People are wearing masks in the grocery stores. It's good. But at the same time, I've been talking to my neighbors all this week, and the consensus seems to be if everyone goes to the lakefront, they're not going to be able to arrest everybody. So just go.
Everybody going to the lakefront is a bad idea. Everybody's walking up and down the street as it is. I mean, we've got miles north to south. If you said, let's create a perfect buffer zone for the city, you would create the lakefront and the bike and walk trails along. That's just more space for people. I don't think it's a bad idea to open up the lake. The Tribune editorialized that it should be opened up on the, was it the 29th or is it on Tuesday? They wanted to open up ASAP.
Memorial Day is Monday, which is going to bring a lot of people to the lakes and toward the county forest preserves. I think they're trying to block parking at the forest preserves. And they may have officers stationed at the underpasses and on the pedestrian bridges to keep people out of the lakefront.
Well, they do now.
I don't know if they're going to keep that up, if it's just going to be a flood of people who are just going to push right by the police. I'm not sure. As Mayor Lightfoot has said, if people just showed common sense and courtesy and stayed away from each other, this probably wouldn't have ever become an issue.
Well, but who's to say they won't do it if they opened up the lake now? There'd be a lot of people there, but maybe we'd all be about 10 feet from each other.
I'll say that we won't. You say, who's to say? I'll say it. I don't think people, I guess, again, I feel like there's a whole subset of people who, yeah, they'll pay lip service to this, but they don't take it seriously.
Eric, at the lakefront, what is a stranger going to do to you that's going to endanger you?
Well, if they are close enough to you and they're talking or huffing and puffing and so on.
I'm sorry, so a stranger is going to stop their jog, come up, stand in front of you, and huff and puff long enough to give you the virus.
They'll walk by you and do that.
You won't get it if they just walk by you.
You can, I think. I think they don't know that you can't do that.
Okay, fine, but you're not going to get 100% on any of this.
I tend to agree with you, John. I think that it's probably not a particular walking past someone on a path is almost certainly not a very dangerous thing to have happen.
Well, you have to account for the celebrity factor also. He's not going to just be by himself on the lake.
That's true. I will be surrounded by well-wishers, and that's going to be a lot. Actually, probably not well-wishers, but surrounded in any case. You know, I think basically you're right, John, that people just passing each other is probably not much of an issue outside. It's more the inside spaces that I think people are worried about, and it's not just even when you're inside just walking past somebody, it's being in around people for a sustained length of time. And that's why church services are different. You know, with all respect to my colleagues who bleed about the liquor store and comparing it to a church, people go into a liquor store and they go out of a liquor store. People sit in church for hours at a time around one another. And that's different as a matter of health. So, yeah, I mean, this gets to the point that we were talking about earlier, which is that as long as these restrictions feel reasonable to people, they will probably abide by them. But as soon as they stop feeling reasonable, as soon as you start rules like you can only play golf in a twosome but not a foursome, which I've said before, I mean, it's ridiculous. And, of course, they are lifting that through Illinois next week. But when you have rules that don't feel right to people and feel like this is just weird paranoia, then they tend to disregard the whole thing. And I think that's dangerous.
Eric, can you explain the red-blue divide on this to me?
Can I explain it? Well, I think it has to do with some of the leadership that Trump has shown or not shown about this and how he really wanted it to go away and didn't want it to be a thing. I kept saying, you know, first he said, oh, there's one guy in from China and that's it. And then we have 30 cases, it's going to go to zero. And so that became, and his cheerleading became something that his supporters sort of had to buy into. So that if you believe in him, and he kept saying it's going to go away, it'll be gone by Easter, and it's just the flu, that believing that became a method of supporting Trump. So that means that, like, wearing a mask suggests that you are afraid of getting sick and that you're not as blithe about it as Donald Trump. I really think a lot of it comes from the top.
And it trickles all the way down, all the way down?
It trickles all the way down because you see Republican leaders, Governor DeWine in Ohio has like an 85% approval rating because he seems to be, he's taken a bipartisan approach. He's taken a scientific approach. He hasn't made it personal, and he is just, he has impressed a lot of people. There's, I think the Republican governor of Maryland is also, is that my right about that? Is that the right state? Is also, has really high approval ratings for that reason.
All the way down to a state lawmaker in Shelbyville, downstate Illinois.
Virginia, yeah.
Yeah, right. Those are the two guys. We've talked to them both. But I mean, and one does parrot Trump, I know, as a supporter. But if Donald Trump had not taken the position he has been, you don't think we would have this red-blue divide on it? That all of this adherence to one side is a result of Donald Trump?
I think it has a lot to do with it. Yes, I do.
Wow. I could understand that on a whole host of issues, but all the way down to my personal, private, public health, about which he knows nothing, he says that stuff, and people in Southern Illinois are therefore buying it because Donald Trump said it.
I think there's some truth to that. Yes, I think the fact that he refuses to be seen in public wearing a mask explains a lot of the attitude about masks that you're seeing, and this set to they had in Springfield yesterday about not wearing a mask. And I really do think that if Trump had shown a different form of leadership on this from the beginning, that this was a moment, an opportunity that Trump could have really shown his presidential bona fides and really shown some great leadership and just cruise to re-election despite the economic collapse, but he chose to be polarizing about it, and this is where we are.
I was wondering if in Illinois, to me it seems it's not a Republican, a Democrat thing, although it is, but it's really a rural versus a metropolitan thing, that the people downstate aren't against the sheltering because they like Donald Trump. They're against sheltering because they don't have any cases of the virus. And that's because they live in a rural area.
I sense that if Donald Trump were telling them every day, take this seriously, this is for your
own good, really,
that they would, they, it would be wearing a lot more easily on them.
Think about that. I mean, because the whole argument is it's not about the, of course, we're worried about our health, but we're dying down here. We've got to be able to support our families and pay our bills. But if Donald Trump said, no, you all go ahead and suffer, they would be doing that.
I think people, it's like the point is well taken, that people increasingly view their personal lives through a political lens. And I think that's true for downstate. And I think it's true for Chicago. And it definitely plays a huge role in the actions that people take. At the same time, you have areas in Southern Illinois that elect Democratic state representatives. I mean, those are the people actually probably feeling the most heat right now from Pritzker's orders, are downstate state representatives who are Democrats. Yeah, that's an interesting thought experiment. If Trump was super pro-mask and super pro-lockdown, would those people's behavior be different? I don't think it would be polar opposites. I think there is some genuine recognition there that, or just a general anti-authoritarianism that kind of reigns in the psyche of some of those folks.
Yeah, I think so. I think that if he had been much more, I mean, Dr. Fauci's approval ratings are like 40 points higher than Trump's, something like that, in terms of the public getting behind him. If Trump had associated himself all along with Dr. Fauci's position, I think it would have gone down easier. Now, there's no question that people are hurting and that they're asking a lot of questions. And you look at Mayor Lightfoot, who was, I think, early on, everyone was like, oh, Mayor Lightfoot, she's so feisty, it's so great, she's close. And now people are like, okay, come on, thanks, Mayor, but we want our lakefront back, we want our golf courses back, we want our restaurants back. And so there is some of that going on. But I think the political divide would not be nearly as stark. And it might just end up being more of a regional divide in terms of opinion, but it wouldn't have ended up to be quite such a red-blue split as it is now.
There's two more things I want to bounce off you guys real quick, and that is at this session in Springfield, graduated income taxes they're looking at that, are they not? How the ballot is going to be worded, isn't that it? The phraseology on that?
Correct. That's correct. They have to figure out the language.
And that's really tricky, isn't it? Do you call it fair? Then everybody's for it. Do you call it more taxes? Then nobody is for that. So I'm kind of intrigued by that.
That process is going to be very, very interesting. So what happens is the Democrats get to basically draft the language. Basically, on the ballot, you get the constitutional amendment, an explanation of what it does, the pro arguments and the con arguments. And that's what you see on your ballot. And that's actually mailed out to everybody, COVID or not, everybody in the mail sort of like gets these arguments. What's interesting is both parties have to vote to approve this language through the General Assembly. And then the Attorney General gets to edit the language for, quote, accuracy and fairness. So we're going to see what that looks like. Is it going to be edited for accuracy and fairness? I don't know. I don't think, I think it's really important that people are drawing attention to the issue. There was a resolution filed to take it off the ballot that Leader Durkin and Brady filed. What's really going to be interesting, I think, in the next 24 hours here is what they do with the election code. And there's a proposal to have an election holiday for all state and for an election holiday for Illinois, but only for state and local government workers, not for everybody else, which I think is a little bit absurd. And I'm in favor of people taking off work for election. I think that's fine to have an election.
I thought the idea of putting Uncle Pennybags from the Monopoly game on the ballot itself, not a fair idea. I think it's, you know, there is this idea that they want to take the graduated income tax question off the ballot. There's a Republican move to do that, which is an interesting poker play on their part. But the thing is that one of the things that I agree with some of the Republicans about some of these issues is I think that there are some of these major questions that should be voted on. And I've been hearing for years, like, well, why can't we vote on remap and changing the way we draw political maps? Or why can't we vote on the pension language? And then to say people deserve to vote. They deserve to vote on this. They deserve a voice. And then to say, well, not on this question. We should take this question away from them in November. That doesn't strike me as good optics.
There's a rally in Chicago this week, and a reporter, talk show host for one of the radio stations in town, Amy Jacobson, was one of the speakers. Since then, as a result, she's lost her journalistic credibility with the state anyway. And am I right, Heather, they're not allowing her to ask questions now at the press conferences?
So the way that it works is that there are two ways people can get press questions answered by the governor. One, you can send it to his press secretary, or you can send it to one of the two pool reporters. And Amy Jacobson had been sending her questions to the governor's press secretary, and the press secretary is now declining to ask those questions to the governor. So she could send them to the pool reporter, and it would be up to that pool reporter as to whether or not that they would get answered. So far be it from me to criticize Robert Feeder, who I consider a friend and a supporter, but I think his article saying that she was banned from the press conference overstated it a little bit. She just isn't being allowed to use the governor's office to ask her questions.
So the pool reporter changes every day, right?
Correct.
And so you can send it to Jordan, who is the press person. And it struck me as odd that she would openly tell Amy Jacobson that, you know, your questions aren't welcome. You could easily just, like, you know, put her questions on the slush pile and just
do that for a day. And then Amy Jacobson lost her stuff on Twitter and demanded a reason as to why her question wasn't answered. So Amy Jacobson forced this to a boiling point.
Okay, I didn't hear that part, but that's an interesting question. And of course, you know, the question, the conversation that broke out on Rob's blog, and it broke out in a lot of social media channels, was, you know, is she a journalist, and does she have a First Amendment right to ask questions of the governor? And, you know, essentially where I come down on this is where the Tribune ethics policy comes in, which is I can advocate for points of view as a columnist, as an opinion person, and Amy has every right to do that as well. But when you participate in rallies, you forfeit the right to call yourself a journalist, that you become an advocate at that point. And maybe it seems like it's a fine line to people, but it does make sense to me. I can't put a bumper sticker on my car or a sign in my front yard talking about who I'm going to vote for, even if I write a column explaining why I'm going to vote for somebody. I can't put a sign out. And again, that's the difference between commentary and advocacy. And she crossed that line. And once you cross that line, it's hard to go back.
My experience has been the rules of radio stations are so much less stringent on all ethical issues. And it's so true than say the print media or maybe the online media. It's just different. And sometimes because our jobs are different too. What is a talk show host? And Amy Jacobson, in my mind, is one of these sort of hybrid journalist talkers who's got quite a reputation prior to this. She's probably one of the better known reporters in this town just because of how she covered the Drew Peterson story years ago.
Lisa Stebbik case. Yes.
Well, if they had sent the question to you, if you were the pool reporter, Heather, and Amy had sent it to you, would you have asked her a question?
That would have been a tough call for me because, you know, when I took this job at WTTW, I also had to sign an ethics agreement that said that I would not advocate for or against political positions. And it's something that you know, I take very seriously as in my role as a journalist. I think that what probably pushed it over the edge for the governor's team was that she appeared at the rally where the Nazi and the really personally attacking signs appeared. I mean, but like to Eric's point, this is not a gray area. You can't be a journalist and participate in a rally. You can't be a journalist and lead a rally. This, you know, just is, you know, black letter law. I also don't think that her questions have been particularly helpful to anybody other than her. All of the questions have been like, hey, governor, when are you going to stop violating our constitutional rights at the lakefront and allow us to go golfing like the good Americans that we all are? So is that what I would choose to use my limited time in front of the governor? Maybe not.
By the way, did you guys, I know, I hate to ask a question that everybody will know the answer to probably by the time we put this up, but did the president wear his face mask in Michigan today? Do we have any video or photography of him with his mask on?
He just landed in Michigan, I want to say less than an hour ago, so I don't think he has appeared either masked or unmasked.
Got it.
I'm going to say no, John.
Darren Bailey masked up to go back to work on the floor of the Illinois House this afternoon after getting kicked out yesterday. He caved to tyranny, right? That's what he told us, right?
Yeah.
He wore his mask, the downstate lawmaker. Well, yeah. I think that the shot of Trump with a, even if it's him ducking in and out of some room where it's really super safe and he's got to have the mask on, will be the equivalent of getting a picture of Barack Obama smoking. Because you knew he was sneaking some cigarettes, but I never saw a really good picture of him with one. And I think somebody's just dying to get that picture, not caving to tyranny, but being a coward, not being a strong man and wearing a mask.
See, here's the thing about masks. If everybody wore the masks in these public settings, especially in these interior settings we're talking about, you would help diminish the positive case count, you would reduce the hospital population, you would make it possible for us to get back to closer to normal. And you would also, over time, we will develop immunities to this. We will also develop treatments and vaccines. This particular virus is not going to be with us forever. But if we can establish some of these new norms, that when this kind of thing happens, this is how we handle it, that we'll be better off in the long run, and then we won't have quite as much tyranny, as Heather calls it.
I think last week, maybe it was 2 weeks ago, we just mentioned a couple of the shows that we've all been sort of diving into to kill some of our free at-home time. And I plowed through Eric Zorn's Schitt's Creek. We're a happier, better family for it. The one that we're spending countless moments in front of now is Dead to Me. I don't know if you guys have watched that, but boy, is that a good show too.
What is the premise of that, John?
Boy, even if I say a little bit, I might give away too much. Well, the opening episode is there's a car crash and a husband and wife kill somebody. And as a result of that, the wife feels so guilty about it, so bad about it, that she seeks out and befriends the grieving widow. And insanity ensues for two full seasons so far. And it is so damn funny. Without trying to be. I mean, it's trying to be. It's dark humor, but there ain't no laugh track to this thing. Have you watched it, Heather?
I have not, but I do enjoy Linda Cardellini and, I forget what the other actress's name is.
Are you a Freaks and Geeks fan, Heather?
Christina Applegate.
Yeah, it's Christina Applegate.
Thanks, Dolph. Yeah. And it's the two of them just killing this thing. Well, if you want to, like, my life sucks, I wish I knew somebody whose life sucks more than mine. Watch this, and you'll realize.
John, are you
a on a ventilator? Somebody's got it worse than you.
John, are you a Freaks and Geeks fan?
No, never watched.
Oh my goodness! Oh, you've got what a treat! I'm envious of you that you get to watch it for the first time because you will love that show.
Okay, I'll go back and watch that. Oh, any so recommendations good. From you, Eric? Otherwise,
I think I mentioned this last week. I am watching Afterlife, the Ricky Gervais. Sitcom is maybe too strong word, but it's a very interesting story. And Ricky Gervais is, I know he's not everybody's cup of tea, as they say, but it's a very good show. It's funny, but it's also very serious in places. And I recommend that. Yeah. It's on Netflix.
I don't have that much more free time, but I did read a whole nonfiction book. I read The Splendid and the Vile by Eric Larson, which is about World War II and how London endured the Battle of Britain and the Blitz. And so much of the book concentrates on how Churchill managed to endure that as a political leader and how he kept Londoners from basically toppling his government and capitulating to Hitler. And I gotta say, our current political status did not compare very well with what they endured in World War II. I mean, whole neighborhoods were leveled overnight and people got up the next morning and went to work. You know what I mean? Like, I can't even comprehend that. So I don't recommend it as a de-stressing technique.
In the Life That Sucks Worse Than Yours category, I read Road to Wigan Pier by George Orwell, where he went to basically a mining town in England and lived as a miner for weeks and weeks. He wrote for a socialist book club to sort of say, like, this is the condition of the working person in the UK. And then, I mean, have you guys heard of this Last Dance documentary everybody's talking about? So I watched that.
It focuses on how Chicago Tonight covered the Bulls championship teams. I mean, every episode, yeah. There was all like John Calaway, Phil Ponce cameo, which was fun for all of us at WTTW.
That sure was a nice respite for us in Chicago. I'm also halfway through The Plague by Albert Camus. And it's amazing how good a predictor that is of all the things we're going through here.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.